You are listening pretty late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, live in our Allstate Showcase Studio South. I am broadcasting from Springfield in our wide coverage of the upcoming solar eclipse. Down here with my family. And joining us in studio is Elliot Serrano and Eric Elk, as they do every Friday night. A lot of important conversations that we've had on Friday, but I don't think anything is important as what we need to talk about this week. I know that it's really, I think if anyone's like me, you've kind of run the gamut on emotions of rage and sadness and fear and maybe a lot of other things going on. And confusion, I think, is definitely something going through our minds. And we want to thank our guest, Christian Piccellini, who joined us on the line. And Christian, I don't want to misrepresent you or even try to describe what you have gone through. But what I've read is that you were formerly in one of the hate groups. You were a skinhead. Is that correct?
That's correct, Patty. Thanks for having me on. You know, when I was 14 years old in 1987, I was a marginalized kid. I was bullied. I didn't have a place that I really thought I belonged, and I didn't know what my purpose was. So as I was searching for, you know, those really fundamental human needs of identity, community, and purpose, one day I was standing in an alley, and a man came up to me, and he recognized that I was vulnerable. And he promised me paradise. He brought me in. What I didn't know about that man was that he was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead, and that the American neo-Nazi skinhead had started right in that alley on the south side of Chicago and Blue Island. And because I wanted to belong to something, eventually I became hooked to this, and I spent 8 years of my life in America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group.
You were 14 years old.
I was 14 years old. Yeah, I spent 8 years until I was 22, uh-huh. And for the last 22 years, I've dedicated my life to helping people get out of the movement that I helped build.
And what people see when they see all these, you know, white young men in places like Charlottesville, or, you know, because I went online, you know, kind of following links and watching some of these videos, some of these men who are trying to recruit. Now they have the recruitment tools online. So to you, this right. must seem like there's an alley in every household now, not just the south side of Chicago.
That's true. There's an alley in every household, and there's a young, vulnerable person in every household as well. You know, so many young people are living online these days, and they may feel like they're bullied or marginalized or just looking for something. And they find a narrative that appeals to them online because they're brought into that community. They're given that purpose. And when you're online, you can be whoever you want. And they become indoctrinated with so much of this information that's out there, this propaganda, conspiracy theories, that it starts to answer some of their questions. Not in the correct way, but it starts to answer them so that they can blame other people for the pain that they're going through. It's very much an us against them mentality.
And when you were, okay, so at 14, and you're brought into this kind of circle of, does it seem like a family? Does it see, you know, what are the experiences? Are you going, you know, hanging out with each other every single day, or we're going to get together on the weekend and cause trouble? Tell me a little bit about those first few years for you.
You know, my parents were actually Italian immigrants who came to the U.S. in the mid-60s. And because they had to work extra hard because they were immigrants, they started a small business and they were gone 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. So I spent a lot of time alone and feeling very abandoned and not understanding at that age that they were, you know, having to work hard to support the family. So, you know, I would spend time by myself. And then when this man brought me in, it was like a community. It was like that family that I was missing. And, you know, it gave me a purpose. I went from powerless to suddenly, you know, something that I thought was powerful. The bullies wouldn't, you know, pick on me anymore, beat me up. They would cross the street because now, after I shaved my head and wore my boots, they feared me. So it fed this feeling of power. It fed my ego. And I was willing to look past and even swallow whole the ideology at that age because I wanted to belong.
Because wanting to belong is intoxicating. I mean, there's something when you feel that warmth of being wanted and needed by a group of people who really, you know, build up your self-esteem. I mean, why wouldn't any 14-year-old who's feeling as though there's nowhere else to go be drawn into that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it did start with boosting the self-esteem. It doesn't start out overnight with recruiting you into a hate group. You know, it started out for me by being told I should be proud of my European heritage, that my ancestors were great warriors and thinkers and artists. And You know, and that boosted my pride. And then, you know, that made me scared to lose that, because they would tell me that because I was proud, somebody wanted to take that away. And then it would go even further and claim that they were the enemy and that they needed to be eliminated. And that's the indoctrination process. And once you're in, you've already abandoned everything else in your life that used to mean something to you. You've given up your family, you've given up your friends, you've given up your hobbies. So once you're in and they know that they bring you in gradually, it's impossible to go back, because you have nothing to go back to. And that's how recruiters work. That's how people are radicalized into groups like ISIS, or even in street gangs in Chicago. They target the most vulnerable because they know that they can promise them something and then shift the blame for what's happening in their life, for whatever is broken, whatever is missing. You know, I call them potholes. It could be trauma, it could be abuse, it could be addiction, it could be mental illness or perceived grievance. For me, it was abandonment. And they promised to fill that void, because they identified in me that if they did that, I would give them everything.
What were some of the things that you look back? I mean, was there a moment, you know, I don't know what necessarily you did along the way, or if you even want to talk about that, but that you went, is this really me? Is this my reality? Or was it always kind of, I'm all in, until you weren't?
You know, it was a gradual process, and I had doubts almost every day that I was involved, because it wasn't part of my family DNA. You know, in fact, my parents, you know, were victims of prejudice when they came to the United States. So it wasn't something that I had prior to this group. It's something that I adopted and learned so that I wouldn't lose that sense of identity and purpose. And, you know, because of that, we and me specifically, I was willing to commit acts of violence against innocent people, people that I hated, because I really hated myself. I hated my own situation, and I wanted to project the pain that I was feeling onto other people. I wanted to demonize other because I felt demonized. So it's just this vicious cycle that, you know, hate just consumes you until you really have nothing left. And then when you have nothing left, you really have nothing left to go back to either.
And that's really, I think, crucial to a lot of gangs, as you mentioned. I mean, you know, gangs and, you know, whether it's in the South Side of Chicago or if it's an organization like ISIS, that is the isolation and leaving you with nobody but the people that have radicalized you.
Exactly. And, you know, I hated people that I'd never in my life had a meaningful interaction with. You know, at 14 years old, I didn't know what a Jewish person was. I never had any meaningful dialogue with African Americans. You know, I was so isolated and afraid that I never built those bridges. So when an opportunity to kind of project my pain appeared, I focused it on the people that I knew the least, because it was easy to blame them because I didn't humanize them. And it wasn't until I started to be exposed to people that were different than me. You know, in 1994, I opened a record store in Alsip, Illinois, on the south side of Chicago. And the purpose was to sell white power music that I was importing from Europe. And it became 75% of my gross revenue. This is before the internet, so people were driving from all over the country to buy it. But because I was also trying to support my family, I decided I was going to sell punk rock music and hip hop music and heavy metal. And when the customers came in to buy that, and these customers were African American, they were Jewish, they were gay, they were Muslim. And at first I bit my tongue. I didn't want to interact with them, but they kept coming back despite knowing who I was and what I had done. And they showed me compassion instead of breaking my windows or threatening me. And it was the compassion that I received from them, the people that I least deserved it from, when I least deserved it, that ultimately transformed me, because it allowed me to humanize them, the people that I'd never in my life had a meaningful interaction with but still chose to hate.
This is such an important conversation. We are talking to Christian Piccolini, who has written the book, Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, and he's a co-founder of the nonprofit peace advocacy organization Life After Hate. And after this week, this is not just important this week, it's important next week, it's important next month, it's important for years to come, to find out how do we, because Christian is working to figure out how to help, and working to help people who have left hate groups, and how do we stop this cycle. And Christian, I'm guessing you've got some ideas on outreach in our communities. Can we keep you for another segment?
Absolutely.
I might get greedy with you. I'm sure that I'm guessing we're still getting phone calls and texts as well. Again, we were talking to Christian. Am I saying your last name correctly, Picciolini?
You got it, just like a peach.
Just like a peach, Picciolini. Do you have a website while we're on break? Maybe people want to take a look at a Twitter account or at your website.
Sure. They can go to our organization's website at www.lifeafterhate.org, or they can type in my name and find my social media. It's all just first letter and my last name.
I'm so grateful that you're joining us tonight. If anyone does have a question or comment, 312-981-7200. Join us. It's your conversation. 312-981-7200. More after this on Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on 720 WGN. You're listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, live in the Allstate Showcase Studios South. I'm in Springfield on my way to Southern Illinois for Monday's solar eclipse, which is the light news of the week. And the important news of the week is what happened last week in Charlottesville, Virginia, when things got very violent. There was a Unite the Right rally planned for Saturday. There were hundreds of ralliers on Friday night, members of the KKK. The Nazis, the white supremacist groups from across the country descended upon Charlottesville, Virginia, with permits to rally and with their, you know, with the support of the ACLU, because there is a First Amendment right in this United States to you know, voice your thoughts, your opinions, and that's one element of it. The element that we need to talk about is why does this happen? And joining us on the line is Christian Picciolini, who is the founder of Life After Hate. He has written a memoir, Romantic Violence: Memoirs of an American Skinhead. At the age of 14, he was recruited by someone who saw someone who was vulnerable. He recruited a 14-year-old boy the same age as my son. And today, that was in 1987. Imagine, Christian, we were talking about this, how much easier it must be to, because I watched some of these videos of leaders going on Facebook Live and calling people turds and other names if they didn't show up, if they didn't have the balls to be in Charlottesville and to show who they were and do, you know, the things that they were talking about. I was just, it's frightening for people, but we need to start paying attention, don't we, Christian?
Oh, I think it's past the time where we need to start paying attention.
It is.
These rallies and this movement has been growing for decades, and we've been warning about it for decades, as have groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center. And in fact, just a few months ago, Department of Homeland Security and the FBI actually wrote a memo to the president saying that white supremacist extremism is on the rise and that we need to focus on it. There doesn't seem to be a focus from our administration on that type of terrorism or domestic extremism. But, you know, rallies like that, Patty, have been happening for years. I describe a whole chapter in my book about a rally that was nearly identical to the one that happened in Charlottesville. And the truth is, you know, we're at a period in our history right now where young people really don't have a lot of hope. Frankly, there are a lot of adults that don't have a lot of hope right now, but especially young people, because, you know, they're disenfranchised, they're disenchanted, they can't afford college. And if they can, you know, get in, they get saddled with debt. There aren't prospects for jobs. And this is across, you know, all the whole demographic. And they're trying to find their way and they're trying to find answers for that. As they're searching for answers, they're finding this propaganda. And, you know, because of algorithms on the internet, just like, you know, when you go to a shopping website and it'll make a recommendation on your past purchases, unfortunately, the internet learns our habits. And if you happen to land on a white nationalist website or a fake news site or some sort of a propaganda or a racist forum, it'll keep recommending those things to you as you search. And that's a problem, because if that becomes your only reality, then when somebody else voices, you know, a counter narrative to that, then you think that they're the ones lying. You think that they're the ones who don't understand your reality. And there are two alternate realities happening, very parallel in America right now. And there are very few bridges, you know, crossing both of those.
Well, what is the bridge back? What is the bridge back when, you know, whether it's to draw people back out of these hate groups? Let's start there. We'll start with how you got out, and is there a way to build that path of you know, giving people hope, or how deeply entrenched are some of these young men? And well, I mean, I know there are women, but obviously we see some of these images of men, you know, it just, and even armed to the teeth, really ready for violence in Charlottesville.
Yeah, I mean, there are research organizations that are estimating there are over 300,000 paramilitary militia members who subscribe to white supremacist ideologies that are currently training in the United States. 300,000. You know, I suspect that if we had 300 ISIS members training anywhere in the U.S., we would be doing something about that. And yet we have the same problem happening here. We saw that in the attack that happened in Charlottesville. And then, you know, we saw something parallel happen in Barcelona. You know, these groups mimic each other. But let me just say something. I have a firm belief that ideology is not what radicalizes people. I really believe that it's the broken search for identity, community, and purpose. If there's something underneath that, a void or a pothole, I call them, things that deviated our path. And like I mentioned earlier, they could be anything from mental illness to chronic unemployment to a perceived grievance. We tend to search for acceptance and negative pathways. We tend to, because we're feeling marginalized or demonized or, outside of, the connection with others, we, you know, sometimes go to desperate measures and look for attention or for acceptance in places that will accept us. And these groups are welcoming with open arms because, they don't care about their members. They know that they kind of just churn them out. And, they work by boosting their self-esteem and then, forcing them to give up everything. It operates just like a cult.
I'm sure a lot of people were stunned by the number, Eric and Elliot, with the number of 300,000 extreme white nationalist extremists training as militants in the United States. And as you mentioned, if there were 300 men who were training for ISIS in the U.S., we would be all over them and we would react differently. Have the numbers grown? I mean, has it been this large? Has it been this really entrenched in our country and we just really have been oblivious for decades, or was there an acceleration to this?
You know, we have been oblivious. We've swept it under the rug for many years, but it's definitely growing. We're seeing so many young people flocking to this that wouldn't normally have gone. Young girls that are going, sometimes as young as 14 years old, who are making videos online, propaganda videos that are Holocaust denial videos, or young men who are putting together, old Nazi propaganda reels that make it seem very heroic to appeal to young men and their need to want to matter. They've gotten very marketing savvy. So over the last 30 years, and even 30 years ago when I started, we started this process of trying to blend in. We recognized that the shaved heads and the swastika flags and the tattoos and the hoods were turning off the average American racist, and we weren't able to recruit them because they saw us as too, outside of the fray. So we said, well, we need to grow our hair. We need to trade in our boots for suits. We need to go to college and recruit on college campuses. We need to join the military to get training. We need to get jobs in law enforcement. We need to run for office. And here we are 30 years later, and we're calling that the alt-right. It's grown, but it's also people are starting to recognize it more because we're talking about it. I get calls from parents every day or emails saying, my son or daughter is just like Dylann Roof. They're starting to read the same books. They've changed their habits. They're online on these websites reading, hate propaganda. I don't know what to do. So this is definitely a problem that is, it's growing. But I have hope. I don't want to paint the picture that, that I'm hopeless about the situation. I really think we're at a turning point in America because of the things that have been happening, because of organizations like Black Lives Matter and, the work that they're doing on the streets to raise awareness for the issues of, injustice. I think America, because of Charlottesville, has said, Proud Americans are not going to stand for other proud Americans to be marginalized anymore. And I think we're ready to stand up against hate.
There's so much there. I have to go to news. Elliot, it sounds like you want to ask something, or Eric, and I have to ask our guests. Yeah, because there was so much there. And Christian, would you mind hanging out for one more segment after midnight? We have to do news. But there is so much there that I know we all want to. We have more questions. Are you up for that?
Of course. Yeah, I'd love to talk about our organization as well, so I'm happy to hang on.
Yes, please. I want to talk about your organization. I know we want to talk about Black Lives Matter. I know what we want to ask you about what your thoughts are with the statements, of course, that the president made this week and went going back and forth and what that impact is. So I just want to give you an idea of what we want to talk about when we come back. We are talking to Christian Piccolini, and he has created co-founded the nonprofit peace advocacy organization Life After Hate, and there is no more important conversation that we should be having, honestly. So I'm so grateful for your time, and I hope that this is just the first of many conversations on my show if you'll join us again. But I'm casting that out there. I'm not going to get any. I don't want to put you on the spot right now.
Let's change the world together, Patty.
Please. You know, just even like a block. I'll take changing a block, and then the next block, and then the next block. You are listening Pretty Late. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, live in our Allstate Showcase Studio South. In our Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, we have Elliot Serrano and Eric Elk. And on the line with us is Christian Piccolini, who is a co-founder of Life After Hate. And he has been really, I think, this is the most important conversation I can remember ever having on our show. And we talk about a lot of things, but after the violence that erupted after a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, a young woman named Heather Heyer was killed. Dozens were injured. But I think everyone is still stunned. There's even more hate because we're on social media and we're attacking each other. And people are digging in because this is also partly political. And a lot of people, Christian, are saying, I've seen a lot of people say, you know, and even on that video with Vice, that documentary that they were there, the journalists were entrenched. And there was a man who said that he became radicalized or he wanted to do something because after Trayvon Martin, after he saw the riots in Ferguson, after Black Lives Matter became an organization. And he said he attributed that directly, in particular, Black Lives Matter. And a lot of people are talking about that group as being the problem, not the white supremacists. And I, you know, people like me, I'm like, I don't even know where to begin on that Black Lives Matter is even on the same playing field, or that they are a terrorist group is what people are calling them. What do you have to say to those conversations?
Well, you know, I don't think any of your listeners ever saw the day when, you know, Americans would be siding with Nazis instead of, you know, people who have the right to protest that kind of hate and injustice. And, you know, that's kind of where we're at. And, it's certainly being fed by the fear rhetoric that came out of the campaign and then into the presidency, you know, divisive language, you know, marginalizing Americans, you know, talk of Muslim ban and immigration. I mean, these are all things that we said 30 years ago, you know, almost to a T. They've marketed it better. They've become more savvy. They've made the language more palatable for Americans to swallow. But the ideas are the same. You know, it's really, you know, we're really living in a time that's very volatile right now. You know, even when I was in the movement, I never thought that we may be this close to some sort of either a civil war or a new civil rights movement. And I really do believe that we're heading towards a new civil rights movement because I've seen people mobilize all over the country. We've received so much support from people, from celebrities, from the media. You know, Life After Hate has been doing this since 2011. We've been a nonprofit based in Chicago, you know, doing this for 6 years. We're the only organization in the Western Hemisphere that is helping white supremacists disengage from that movement. And everybody at Life After Hate is a former white supremacist, a former extremist who's been out for decades. And collectively, we've been doing this for 20 years. On our own, and we decided to come together to help people out of this movement that we were a part of because we recognized how difficult it was to extract yourself. So, you know, what we do is we work with people, and sometimes, you know, parents refer us or friends of people refer us, or sometimes people themselves come to us and ask for help because it's dangerous to leave. It's very hard to leave because it's difficult to give up that identity and purpose and community because you have nothing to go back to. So what we do is we first of all don't argue ideologically with them. We're not interested in polarizing further. We listen, and we listen for those voids or those potholes that exist in their lives, and then we start to fill those potholes in. We work on the resiliency of people by providing services through partners that provide education or job training or life coaching or mental health therapy or tattoo removal. I'm actually in Lexington, Kentucky right now working with a young individual who I've been working with for over a year, and we went today to get his first laser treatment to remove the Nazi tattoos from his face. So we try to work on the resiliency of the human. The way we challenge the doctrine and the ideology is that I will actually introduce them to people that they think that they hate. So I may bring a Holocaust denier to meet with a Holocaust survivor, spend a day with them, or an Islamophobe. We may go have dinner with a Muslim family or go talk to an imam. Or if it's somebody who is a homophobic, we may go spend a day at an LGBTQ center. And it's all about humanizing the people that they've been demonizing in their head, because, 9.5 times out of 10, they've never in their lives had a meaningful interaction with the people that they hate. So my goal is to put them together so that this individual can humanize these people and work on the ideology by getting them to understand that their ideology is wrong without me telling them. And that's what we do. And then we also have a network online. It's a private network of over 100 people that we've helped disengage over the last couple of years. Globally, we've set up chapters in Slovakia. We've helped set up a UK chapter. We've worked with folks in Australia to set one up. And people, who are running these chapters are all people that were like me. All people who were part of this movement, and they understand the people that they work with because they were the people that they work with. They understand the language, they understand the motivations, but they understand more importantly that the way that people disengage from these movements, regardless of what brand of extremism it is through compassion and empathy, because that's something that they were lacking, and that's something that they never received from other people and somehow went off astray on a different path. So we're trying to bring them back just by connecting them to people so that they can't reconcile the prejudice anymore, that they can't reconcile the hate. And we've been very good at that.
This has become such a international story, of course, because not only did we have this violent rally in Charlottesville, but I know that Eric had a question about what the aftermath, the way our leaders have responded. Eric, what do you want to ask Christian about that?
Yeah, Christian, I'm curious, get your perspective in terms of the response from elected leaders or lack of response. What impact does that have with this movement?
Well, I think it emboldens them further. It legitimizes them in their eyes and even to other Americans. It's become part of our everyday discourse. Our news and media can't, stop focusing on this, although we should be focusing on it. So it's something that's, over the last 18 months has become a regular part of our everyday discussion. And there's a danger to that because, it empowers them, but it's also important to be able to expose it because we need to understand that this exists and that, we're not living in a post-racial society, that there are people still facing injustice and that there are people who are joining these groups that can be brought back, that they can change, they can get back on the same track that they were on. And I know hundreds of people, if not thousands, who've done that. People who've gone on to be doctors and architects and parents and teachers, some of the most amazing people that I've ever met. But I'm glad you brought that up because the language that I heard coming out of that press conference, if we can call it that, was a dog whistle to me. I heard support.
Okay, I want to stop right because that's something that I've said, and I think that's really important. Can you explain what you mean by a dog whistle when the Republican president said what he said about there are good people on both sides? What do you mean
sure.
by dog so, whistle? Yes.
So a dog whistle is essentially a coded quote unquote message to certain supporters that normally kind of flies over the head of everybody else. It's not, it's kind of like the use of the Star of David during the campaign ad over Hillary Clinton's face and the use of George Soros's face in that ad because he's the most demonized philanthropist Jewish person from the far right. So they put these kind of hidden things in there, and even in their language, by saying things like the liberal media. Well, 30 years ago, and it's changed over the years, but 30 years ago, we used to just call it the Jewish media. Now they've started to kind of polish their words to make them a little bit more acceptable so that when people hear it, it's not overt. So, you know, there have been many instances of that. And what I heard come out of the president's mouth was, you know, condemnation of the KKK. I heard condemnation of the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists. But there was no condemnation of the alt-right, which is a faction of this white supremacist movement. And, you know, we know that there are people in the administration who are very tied to this movement. People like Steve Bannon, who was fired today. People like Sebastian Gorka. People like Stephen Miller. You know, these people are very involved in driving policy, and it affects Life After Hate very much. Because in January of this year, before President Obama left office, we were actually awarded a $400,000 grant to continue our work, because they recognized how important it was to have a community-led approach to helping people disengage from this movement. We'd been successful doing it. So we won a $400,000 grant 2 weeks before President Obama left office. And then when the new president took office, that grant was rescinded from us without any explanation as to why. And of the 31 organizations that won this grant, we were the only organization that focused on white extremism. And, you know, without an explanation for that, that certainly could be interpreted as support for that movement, because they certainly haven't called it out as a problem. They haven't focused resources on it as a government. And in fact, they've been pulling back resources from organizations that are combating it.
Oh, boy. Elliot, I know you had a question before we let our guest go, who's been very generous with his time. Elliot?
Yeah, Christian, first let me say that what you're saying has just been so incredibly inspiring. So I want to thank you for sharing that. I'm someone who's like been following a lot of this on social media, and I'm sure you're aware, you know, the reactions to this on social media has gone to a lot of extremes. I've had everyone like on my social media posting saying, you know, we should just ignore this sort of thing. You know, like I've had some folks say, well, if we had just ignored the Charlottesville protesters, you know, the media had ignored them, it wouldn't have come to anything. And then you've had people on the opposite side who say, you know, you see a Nazi, you punch a Nazi, right? So my question to you is this, because you said, you know, people were walking into your store and, you know, pretty much showing you love, compassion, and empathy, and that's what changed you. What is a thing that we can do in the community when we're struggling between, do I ignore this or do I punch a Nazi? You know, well, we don't want to do that, I guess. But, you know, what is a thing, like an action that we can take that kind of helps illuminate that path to someone, you know, in a way? It's like a simple thing that we can each do in our lives to hopefully send someone like this in the right direction.
Well, I can tell you, you know, since the founding of our country, we've been ignoring this problem in large part. So that's really not the right course of action. There are people who need us, who are depending on us to listen to them, and we need to start listening. If we punch a Nazi, I can tell you that in the history of Earth, I'm sure nobody has ever changed their racist views because they got punched in the face. In fact, I would imagine that would make them angrier, that would polarize them further. And I can tell you that at 18 years old, had somebody punched me in the face, I likely would have come back with something a little bit more than a punch. So that's really not going to work either. What we really need to do, and, you know, maybe consider this a challenge, you know, for your listeners or for yourselves, you know, go out there and find somebody who you don't think deserves compassion and give it to them, and see what happens. Because I think you'll be surprised that you'll see that it just kind of changes their trajectory a little bit, and it also will fulfill you. And those little actions change the world. Because, you know, when people ask me, how do we solve racism? I say, I don't know. If I knew that, I would have won a Nobel Peace Prize by now. But I know that I can affect the people closest to me, my friends, my family, my coworkers. Stand behind the people who are being hurt and listen to the people who are doing the hurting. And when you listen for the clues on what it is that they're missing and try and find a way to connect them to that. And that's what changes people.
Well, I hope that even if there's just one person that goes, oh, I had no idea, and I can be open to having these conversations and then another conversation. I want to thank our guest, Christian Picciolini, for making that difference tonight for someone out there. And I think really for people who are scared and angry, this is something that we needed. I can't thank you enough, really. Thank you so much, Christian. And I was telling my producer, whenever it fits your schedule, we would love to have you in studio, and I'm sure have a longer conversation when you can stay up pretty late with us. I know you're on the East Coast, so this was kind of you to stay up so late.
Well, I miss home. I'm coming home on Sunday right after I do a taping of Face the Nation. And I'm happy to come in anytime. And if I could just say one more thing, since we lost that funding in the last 4 days after Charlottesville, we launched a crowdfunding campaign. And in 4 days, we've already raised $230,000. We're trying to get to our goal of $400,000 so that we can launch the program that we wanted to launch, which is an online intervention program. We've gotten amazing support from people like Samantha Bee and all of our amazing supporters. And it's been very overwhelming and incredible.
Where can people help you out with that to make sure that they're informed and involved?
They can go to lifeafterhate.org, and there's a donate button right there that'll tell our story, and there's a video that people can watch to hear what we use the money for.
Well done, sir. I mean, I don't mean this conversation. I mean, in all the work that you're doing, this is going to be a long, and you have been doing a long haul when it comes to trying to make a difference. So really, we're very grateful and look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you, Patty. It's going to take all of us to make it happen. It's good talking to you.
Yes, it will take all of us. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.